Good afternoon. This is Gary Kavanagh here with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. We are here slightly late because I had a bout of of illness, but we are still here theoretically this week. You're probably going to have to give us the one day's credit, but we got there, Michael.
We're heroes. Well, you're a hero. I'm just a sideline on cheering on the heroes.
Don't sell yourself short, Michael. You're my secretary.
It's possible that if you wake in the last moments, the words that you'll hear are Trotsky.
To be killed by an ice pick is kind of bougie.
I'm sure that's what Trotsky thought. And the last moment of consciousness flittered away from his brain. Oh, ice pick, bougie, yeah.
Anyway, so we will be talking about the story I had during the week there with the Department of Justice and the FOI. We'll get into that. But I actually wanted to start, Michael, with a little bit less of a serious story, but an interesting one nonetheless. You may have seen the reports in the news over the last couple of days that young men are being fed, Michael, fed toxic content, misogynistic content, that they are being bombarded with this kind of content by social media based on the results of a new study from DCU, the Anti-Bullying Centre.
The Anti-Bullying Centre, that's a very useful thing.
Yeah,
I did see this, and actually I saw bits of it, and I thought of you. Listeners might think, well, naturally, Michael saw a study on bullying, and his thoughts turned to Gary, and I could see why you'd think that. But I'm sure you have more and interesting details, but there's the one thing that I noticed was they took a swipe at Stoicism.
Yes, they did. I mean, I thought, you know, I'd just have a look into this because it seemed like an interesting thing. And also some of the ways this was being described online, I think RTE said, you know, it was bombarding boys with misogynistic content and that the algorithms used by social media platforms, that they were, I think it was massively amplifying misogynistic and male supremacist content. So I thought, you know, I'll have a look into this, Michael.
Yeah.
And you know, you glance through these things and you do have to say, you get to phrases like, you know, the heteropatriarchal nuclear family or a discussion of the fallacy of the idea that if you work hard, you'll make it. And you have to kind of think to yourself, I wonder if the people who reported on this read it, you know, just got a general sense of it, because it's a bit, I would say, Michael, ideological. It contains this phrase about Stoicism, actually. The Manosphere's revival of Stoicism also segues neatly into a particular response to the mental health crisis amongst men. Rather than acknowledging that the pressure to conform to heteropatriarchal norms is harmful to men, the Manosphere construes male suffering as attributable to feminism, progressives, and attempts to make men more like women. Which, whatever you think of it, is not a scientific statement. It is a statement of raw, unfiltered ideology.
Yeah, it's theory. It's pure old fashioned. You're saying about, you know, whether you thought people had read it or not. I had the same thought. It actually only reminded me of what, in that context, was listeners may remember. I don't know. It's a while ago now. It was before the last election, so it's a good while ago. One election, anyway. Do you remember the National Women's Council put out a kind of a policy statement or a manifesto? And all these TDs started to sign up to it.
Oh, the one where it was very clear that none of them had actually read it, because I believe it included a commitment basically to get rid of the national herd.
Yeah, well, they were committed to a year-on-year reduction of 8%, I think it was, carbon. I mean, it was just absolutely impractical. If I remember. And I may be misremembering, but I think we worked out at the time that they were looking for a greater year-on-year carbon reduction than we had seen over the period of COVID, when you'd seen the economy basically shut down in large part. But they were going that we wanted this year-on-year. They wanted it. Was it? Oh, it was basically, it was kind of an attack on capitalism and the nuclear family and all sorts of good stuff. And it was plain and obvious that it had been sent out by somebody in the press office in Mount Street and been. The TDs had got it and been told to sign it, and they signed it because we got onto a couple, and literally within minutes, names started to disappear from the online version of it as people were re-yoked. Oh, for God's sake, take my name off that. And I had that similar reaction. Other than the fact, why would you read it? I mean, just the experience, the prose, like phrases, that kind of thing. And I don't like it when it happens, to be honest, either on the left or on the right. Sometimes they hit on a mean which has some a bit of wit to it. But they become so used so quickly, they become these awful cliches. That phrase, manosphere, that kind of language. And what was it? The heteropatriarchal nuclear family, I think, was that one of the phrases?
Yes.
And when you're reading something and you read it, heteropatriarchal nuclear, yeah. Okay, I have a fairly decent idea where we're coming from here. And would you call this, is this a report? Is this a study? Or is this a polemic?
It's technically a study. So, you know, let's treat it as such. What they wanted to know was how quickly people were recommended what they called toxic material online. They set up a variety of, I think it was 5 different variants of new accounts on social media, primarily, I believe, TikTok and YouTube, where they pretended to be a young man, and each one had different interests, basically. And then they sat through it. But there's a couple of problems with it, both on the qualitative side and the quantitative side, I just wanted to touch on. Because it's very fun to mock the ideological position that these people are clearly coming from. But, you know, if they want to do things in a quantitative way, Michael, let's deal with it as a quantitative piece of work. So there's 5 things they looked for: alpha masculinity, misogyny, anti-feminism or sexism, reactionary right content, conspiracy content, and known actor generic content. So that is what they say is content produced by a known manosphere actor, which is not toxic or does not fit into the above categories. They give the example of Jordan Peterson talking about eating only red meat, which is to say that Jordan Peterson would presumably be a known manosphere actor under this categorization. But anything that came into the first 4 of those, they said was toxic. So alpha masculinity, they said, was any content which promotes rigid and prescriptive ideas of masculinity focused on dominance, physicality, aggression, discipline, wealth, or emotional stoicism. Misogyny, anti-feminism, or sexism, they said it was any content which degrades or is derogatory or dehumanizing towards women, which stereotypes women, or which is opposed to gender equality and feminism. Reactionary right was any content which promotes typically far-right and anti-progressive ideologies, racism, anti-immigration, anti-LGBT, anti-trans, etc. And conspiracy was anything related to vaccination, climate change, great replacement, globalism, conspiracies to harm or disempower Andrew Tent. Now, they don't give all of their coding sheets, but they do include one of them. And you can see on it that one of the things that appears the most is what they call wealth porn, which they're referring to as toxic. But the way they did this is actually very simple. They got all these accounts and they basically just did iterative searches to see how much material they were actually being recommended. And they divided it into 8 rounds of checking out platform content. So what they would do is they would scroll through the 50 first videos suggested on the accounts page, looking at a few seconds of each video and then scrolling on to the next video. And then between the accounts, they would put in different search functions. So they would have a account that was looking particularly for kind of what they call, you know, toxic or manosphere content. And that would search for things like Andrew Tate or, you know, alpha masculinity.
Yeah.
And then they would have what they called the gender normative generic account, which would search for football, gaming, gym tips, things like that. And then what they would do is they would go through and like the top 5 videos for each round, but they would also go through, as you said, the 50. And any video they found that had what they term problematic content, they would watch and like the video until they had a total of 400 videos. Now, that is not how any normal person would actually use social media.
Okay.
What they're doing is, all of these platforms have algorithms that recommend content to you based on your previous interactions. So if you listen to a lot of music, they will suggest you more music. If you listen to, you know, if you watch a lot of sport, they will recommend sport. If you start finding videos that contain content about, let's say, stoicism, Michael,
yes,
and you start liking and watching those videos, they will recommend more videos that touch on those trends to you. So what's happening here is every round where these people look for these videos, they increase the likelihood that they'll find them in the next round. Now, the point they're trying to make is basically that these algorithms are drivers of radicalization, because once you watch one video, you'll get recommended more videos. But what they are doing is they are deliberately consuming this content in order to maximize the output of it, until effectively you reach a point where these are nearly the only videos you see, because this is the only thing you're showing interest in. And that, I think, is the problem. You've seen a lot of this research recently coming out, and it's all focusing on the idea of what they call recommender algorithms. Now, you have people like the ICCL who are pushing for these algorithms to be turned off, which, just to be frank here, would make everyone's experience of YouTube and things of that nature worse, because then it couldn't take into your account your likes, yeah, what you actually wanted to see. That's all this is. It provides content to you that it thinks you would like. Now, people have argued that this is, as I said, radicalization, because once you see one, you're likely to see more. And to an extent, it is true that you're likely to see more, until the point that you disengage with it. If you watch one of these videos and then start watching a load of football, you'll get less of these videos. But if this is all you do, which is effectively what they did here, that's all you're going to see. And you can see by round 8, they were pulling in like 80% of all the videos they saw had what they said was toxic content. Now, I would very much be interested in seeing their actual log sheets for this, because I think it would be fair to say, Michael, that their view of toxic content is quite broad.
Yeah, so just for the layman's clarity here, you're saying that the way they did this meant that it was inevitably going to become a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Is that right?
Yeah, so they, as I said, they every time they did this, every iteration of it until they'd seen 400 videos, they would like and watch any video they saw that had problematic content, and then they would search again, and they would like and watch any video that had problematic content, which is to say you were training the algorithm that this is the only thing you like.
So by doing that, every time they did that, they would amplify the probability that the next round would include more of those of the same type of material.
Absolutely. So they're using a passive system which is there basically to provide content which is to your interest. And what you are doing is every time it gives you a particular type of video, saying, yes, absolutely, that's what I want to see more of. But because you're doing it in that way, you don't have like the normal functioning of these, where someone might watch a political video and then they might watch, you know, a comedy routine, or they might watch a snippet of a show or some music or some sport, and it's all mixed together. They basically just isolated this down to, we only want to see the terrible thing that we are trying to measure. And then basically you put a report going, it turns out that people are being bombarded with this. I'm like, no, a person who did what you did would be bombarded with this, because they are telling the algorithm that it's the only thing they want.
So on the technical side, I would say obviously that seems that it's going to produce the result that they want it to produce. So that's a problem, rather than actually mimicking the way that people behave in the real world, that this is an artificial manner of behaving which is going to produce that the thing that they wanted. But for, I suppose for me, I'm also just curious regarding what they scored as being problematic. Because you give the list of things like misogyny, blah, blah, but in the middle of all of that, there are things that you could stop and say, hold on now, if you're somebody who isn't from the left, hard left, far left, whatever, I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily regard that as being, say, conspiracy. For example, I think a lot of people might have political opinions about globalism and globalization and the economics of that and the social consequences of that, which are, frankly, fall a long way away from being a conspiracy theory. I think if you're engaging with certain people, like if you're, I would imagine, I don't know, maybe I'm being unfair, but say for example you read a lot of Lomborg on climate change, or was it Judith Curry, the ex-professor from Georgia Tech, who has become something of a, I mean she's not a climate skeptic, but she's a skeptic regarding a lot of the modeling and the predictive force of the modeling. chances are, I suspect in this kind of thing, it's going to fall under the category of again, conspiracy, because these are by the people from a certain perspective considered to be conspiracy theories. But right down to, as I said, Stoicism. I mean, for example, so if I go through if I start looking at lots of, I don't know, videos about Seneca or Marcus Aurelius or virtue ethics. I mean, virtue ethics is a very important contemporary movement in contemporary moral philosophy. And virtue ethics tends to be a combination of either of Aristotelian ethics or a modern Stoic ethic. Cognitive behavioral therapy, I think a lot of has been influenced by Stoicism and Stoical thought. You know, these things don't bother me. The fact that academics do them, this is what academics do. I don't like the idea that we should go around to universities and tell people, you should research this, but you shouldn't research that. You should write essays about this, you shouldn't about that. I mean, partly, I do think your tax dollars are paying for this kind of research. So, I mean, you might have a problem with that. But it's the passivity with which these things are reported is kind of tedious. How much time have we spent in the last few years doing meta stories about a report was published, you know? Like, I mean, the most obvious one that always comes to my mind, remember the story it was reported about was it a study that had been done on flavors of vapes that had caused Simon Harris to be convinced that we needed to look at banning flavors for vapes for children or something?
Oh, the one that was written up in the Irish Times by their health editor, and when we looked into it, was based on a single focus group of, I want to say, six children.
Yeah, that one. And that was written up as a report in the Times. And that's just one that comes to my mind. But again and again and again, this kind of stuff is happening.
You're never going to let that one go.
No, because it's just so ridiculous.
On where you were asking what actually was considered, the content that they looked at, they said the most common type of toxic content they found was alpha masculinity. So what they said was content pushing rigid and prescriptive ideas of masculinity focused on dominance, physicality, and emotional stoicism. And then the next was misogyny, anti-feminism, which, not the same thing.
No, not the same thing.
And then they say the next common type was reactionary right-wing content, which they said was content primarily focused on right-wing American punditry with a focus on anti-trans and anti-woke content. So they're your top three. And all three of those, I think, are kind of questionable. And obviously TikTok and YouTube were slightly different. The breakdown were different, but they kind of came up in roughly the same frequency.
So anti-trans, if somebody was reading a lot of stuff about the CAS report, would that count as anti-trans? I wonder.
Where they were talking about the top influencers, they say the top influencers either within the manosphere or with reactionary right-wing punditry. Andrew Tate is number one.
Yeah, okay.
But Jordan Peterson is number two. Yeah. Donald Trump is number three.
Right.
So, and I mean, Piers Morgan is also on the list.
That would be a funny dinner party.
Yeah, so particularly the Jordan Peterson part of it, what is he saying that they have particular issue with? Now, they go into it here, and they do explain some of it during the survey, but it's not really quite clear. This seems very much like there's a lot of ideology and a lot of personal view in how they define these things. And particularly the Stoicism stuff, like a lot of the Stoicism stuff that they describe as toxic, like, one of the examples they give is a guy called David Goggins, who's a ex-Navy SEAL, motivational kind of YouTuber. I'm actually not quite sure how to describe Goggins. He's kind of a number of things. And what they do is, their quote is, "You need to fucking work harder. You need to fucking discipline your mind better. All the time you're complaining, you could be instead hustling."
Okay.
Now, I'm not quite sure what's toxic about that.
Hustling? Maybe they don't like the word hustle?
Well, they say it's an example of military-style neo-stoicism.
You see, this is just a word melange, a salad of they just words they've thrown out. They don't really neo-stoicism.
Actually, no, Michael, if you love that, I've got an even better one. Are you ready for this one? The Stoic Industrial Complex.
The Stoic Industrial... Jesus, yeah. I'll tell you, Seneca would have loved that.
Seneca would have loved that, wouldn't he?
God almighty. I think the Stoics would have said that an undue interest in wealth or health was not virtuous. That they are not in themselves the things that make a man virtuous or wise.
It's kind of weird here because they give some examples of some of the videos they show. And a lot of them are just like, go earn money, don't be broke, you know, go and work out. And then other ones are just like, women don't deserve jobs. And you're like, maybe there should have been consideration of, these are not the same thing.
You know, you quoted that Brazilian martial arts guy who was talking about the fact that everybody should read Von Mises. And I think everybody should read Von Mises. I've a fondness for Von Mises. I don't know if it was the founding meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society. He got in an absolute bait with all the other people and stood up and shouted, "You're all bloody socialists," and stormed out of the room and had to be calmed down by Friedrich von Hayek, who said, "Well, no, maybe they're not actually all socialists. But yeah, why not read von Mises?" But well, number one, I'm certain that that kind of guy saying that kind of thing would fall into the category of this kind of toxic masculinity. But isn't there a weird thing going on at the moment where this, with physical fitness and gym culture and all that, is now being perceived as being a kind of a manifestation of a far right disposition? There's this odd culture shift going on there.
There is actually a quite funny point in it where they're talking about the prevalence of racism in the manosphere. And they go, there's a notable absence of overtly anti-immigrant or racist content recommended to our experimental accounts. This may be attributable to the increasing ethnic and religious diversity of manosphere influencers, which reminds me of that wonderful line. I believe it was Canada, where one of the groups that were called white supremacists had a Samoan leader.
No, that's right. Yeah.
And there was a discussion about the increasing diversity of the white nationalist movement.
Was that the Proud Boys?
Oh, sorry, it was the Proud Boys, yes. Yes.
And I think the front face was the guy was a Samoan, and the number two was East Asian or something. But it was an interesting. They talked about how interesting it was the way that white supremacy was becoming more and more ethnically diverse.
Just one of those things where perhaps you should stop and say, you know, just listen to what you've said and go, am I wrong about something?
Yeah,
here?
There are times where
this doesn't seem to be how that should work.
These are things you need to say out loud and listen to it and think, maybe not. Maybe there's one of these things is not like the other. Yeah, one of these things is not the same. But it's good fun.
There is actually an interesting one here where they talk about basically you go onto this and then you start getting wealth porn. And then you start getting onto Trump, and then you get to the Stoic Industrial Complex, and then you start getting onto the reactionary anti-trans content, and then it starts talking about anti-trans, saying that most of the anti-trans content came from the British journalist Piers Morgan, and to a lesser extent from far-right influencers Matt Walsh and Ben Shapiro.
Far-right. Ben Shapiro and Matt Walsh are far-right now. I mean, okay.
Famously. But Here's the wonderful line. Analyzing recommended content from the perspective of real users thus demonstrates the way in which anti-feminist, male supremacist, and far-right narratives merge together into a seamless and mutually compatible set of talking points collectively underpinned by the logic of conspiracy. And to be gentle here, Michael, to those listeners who are feminists, considering the feminist belief in the patriarchy, which again is, you know, a behind-the-scenes control of everything you do, which you can't quite put your finger on, but, you know, is absolutely there controlling your life, I would hesitate to call others, you know, guilty of engaging in conspiratorial thought.
Well, you know, the patriarchy is a multifaceted thing, and I would say that the patriarchy, I think, would mean different things to different feminists, but it is a thing out there which it's maybe hard to define.
I think that The point I would say there is a feminist describing the patriarchy, an anti-Semite describing a global conspiracy of the run be, world being run by Jews, only differs in the person at the end they say is responsible.
Okay, well,
up to that point, they are legitimately indistinguishable.
I will leave Gary to defend that position for himself.
Do you think that I'm just going to sit here and say that all of feminist thought on patriarchy is wrong? Because I will.
No. I'm just perfectly happy to let you do that, Gary, and you can do that with all the aplomb that you usually gather in these situations. However, that is, I think we should move on to something, I was going to say less conspiratorial, but maybe conspiratorial also, which is the rather, I find, astounding series of, what would you call them, observations, pieces of advice, whatever, new information that we have received, that we believe that the minister would have received, other ministers may have received, the Attorney General may have received. But one thing we can be certain, sure of, Gary, the public who were going to vote on the constitutional amendments at the beginning of March did not receive, but came out recently into the hands of those boys at Crypt from the Department of Justice. Now, maybe it's going to take some time, but we've had the newspapers, the Weekenders, we've had the Sunday papers. Well, the two things I want to, first of all, let's talk about the substance of the thing itself and what it says and what it means and all that. But the other thing is, again, to talk in a meta fashion, is the dog that didn't bark, because I would have expected a greater degree of interest from other media outlets, and maybe I've missed it. Maybe you will be able to tell me what the stories that we have, and I would be interested to see how they've been covering it, if they have been. But otherwise, so Gary, let's get into what they said. What were these pieces of advice or opinion pieces? That, and first of all, explain. It starts off with the central piece that we're looking at. It starts off as a kind of a survey within the department. Is that right?
Yeah, so what we have here is we have Department of Justice material, which I was able to get through the FOI process. I've been trying to get this since kind of mid-January, and I was they stalled, then they refused, we had to appeal. We've got a lot of it. A lot of it is redacted. I have 200 or 300 different pieces of material I'm still trying to get from various departments about the referendum. And what I've basically been trying to find out since January is what were civil servants inside the various departments saying about this? Did it match what we were being told during the referendum that there were absolutely no concerns? And what we've got back now is work from within the Department of Justice, where when the amendments, when the referendum was put forward and the government confirmed it was going to happen, the department undertook an internal survey of all of the parts of it that worked in with immigration and asylum processes, and basically said, you know, what do you think this is going to do? Mm. Is this going to be a problem? What are you doing that will be impacted by it? Do you have any concerns over any particular law? Things of that nature. Now, this was intended to be collated internally and then passed on to the Attorney General. We can't say for certain if ministers were actually made aware of this. What I suspect the government will say here, Michael, is that they changed the wording from what was put forward internally in the department. The department has redacted every mention of the wording of the amendment as it was being considered by the department, so we can't tell if it changed. And I would imagine the government will say that, well, they had attorney advice from the Attorney General that said there was going to be no impact from these changes. And basically, the Department of Justice lost the run of themselves and they were absolutely wrong. And, you know, that's why we didn't have any thoughts about
yeah.
it. I don't think that is quite the conversation stopper that they'll want it to be, because the problems that are highlighted in this survey and coming from quite senior people in various parts of the department are fairly wide ranging. So even if the Attorney General did say there's no problem, I would be quite interested in hearing his thoughts on why there's no problem.
Mm.
Because it would seem like the points that are made are kind of difficult to avoid. Once you see them laid out in black and white, you do sort of go, yes, actually, that makes a lot of sense. That's kind of what you would assumed would happen.
Yes.
And we do know from the Attorney General's advice that leaked before the referendum that the Attorney General did not quite say these changes would have no impact. It was very much a hedging, very much a, you know, it's difficult to say how the courts are going to go on this. It wasn't a, there's absolutely no chance anything will happen here. But anyway, that's what I think they will say. What these say is that any amendment to Article 41, which was the family referendum, mm-hmm. would be absolutely disastrous. Would, in the terms of this report, well, let's see exactly what they said. They make the point that the state has been able to maintain the immigration precisely because Article 41 is applied to a small, tightly defined group of people, and that if it is expanded, the state will not be able to regulate immigration if the protection under Article 41 is applied any more widely. They say that it is no... It's no exaggeration to say that it will be extremely difficult and perhaps impossible to maintain a meaningful immigration system should the people accept these amendments. So what we have, as I was saying, is the survey of these departments, and we have the senior legal researcher inside the department who was tasked with carrying out this survey and their comments on it, their summary of it. Their summary, based on what they've received from the departments, ranging from the visa department to, you know, the family reunification, to the border unit, is that the summary of all legal issues so far is that the amendments as currently worded will massively restrict the state's ability to regulate its immigration system. Every single area of this, from the International Protection Agency to the visa to the permission to remain unit, all of them say that this will be a problem. Now, part of the survey asks them, you know, this is the wording the government is considering. What will this do? So the government, I think, can say, well, we changed the wording there. You don't get to see what the wording was, but we assure you we changed it enough that, you know, this is not an issue. However, the problem they have is there's also a question which says, just generally, what would amending Article 41 to include non-marital families do for you? Which is what was put to the people in the end. And they are excoriating on it. They go into great detail about how this is just going to be absolutely non-workable. The border unit, for instance, points out that at the minute, if someone comes to the border and says, you know, we're married, you go, okay, do you have a marriage certificate? And they say we do. And you go, great, perfect. If someone comes to the border and says, well, this is my niece, you know, we're in a durable relationship, what documentation can we ask for?
Yeah. I think they have a real problem, as you said. Without knowing precisely what the wording of the amendment that they were working under, we can't know if that wording was substantively different from the wording that was given. So they will be in a position to say, well, actually, we took on board the concerns and the criticisms, and we changed the wording in order to avoid those. The problem is exactly as you say. When it says is non-marital family.
Non-marital family.
And that, whatever choice of language they could have used, the choice of language they did falls within precisely that category, non-marital family. Other durable relationships. So relationships which are not based on marriage, because it's marriage or. So that's what it is. That, and this is what they're giving their opinion. And I think what is interesting is, pretty well across the board, there was a unanimity of response that everybody seems to have been negative about this. I think, was there one section in with one question said they were, it's not really something that we deal with, it's not going to be for us, not an issue.
Yeah, there was one section that actually, it wasn't even so much that they just seemed very lackadaisical about it, which is, that's not our problem.
Right.
That's not our problem. And it was a section called the Dublin Unit, but I don't actually know what they do inside the immigration services.
Mm. So,
whereas
I think
the other one's kind of clear what they do. Dublin Unit, not quite sure.
But when you look at, like, to the visa unit or the unification unit, whatever it is, the border units, they all come back pretty consistently with the same kind of message. So even if the Attorney General had a different assessment of the situation, and I think we could be sceptical that the Attorney General had a fundamentally and clear different conception of what the problems might be, because what we saw after the amendment suggests that the Attorney General had concerns, or at least recognized that there were potential concerns, but felt on balance the consequences would be X, Y, and Z, which would not be problematic, could be sorted out. But that was very much a kind of, his statement seemed to be on balance, I feel. But the idea that you're going to be, that they can have such, I mean, the language here, Gary, is strong. I mean, they're not holding back. They are using really, what surprised me reading this was the strength of the language for civil servants. You have the very much the sense that these are civil servants privately talking to each other and wanting to be clear so everybody understands what we're talking about here. They may be, if they were talking to the press or to the public or to the minister, they might change their language. But this was a kind of an internal discourse, and people were just being open and frank. And they used very, very strong and clear language. The idea that all of these people could have been just simply wrong and wrong-headed on all of this stuff, it strikes me as unlikely.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think happens, and why we haven't seen this in the other press, is I would say, because we gave this to a number of other Irish outlets, and I think the Irish, maybe the Mirror covered it, and I was on Highland Radio in Tipperary, they covered it as well. But I suspect what's happened with most of these outlets is they have reached out to government sources, and the government sources have said, you know, privately, that basically the story is nothing, that we had Attorney General advice, that this is just, you know, mid-level officials in a department stress testing legislation, something like that.
Yeah.
And those people have basically went, okay, yeah, that's a reasonable explanation. I see no reason for me to question this further. Whereas I think the point you raised, Michael, is this, even if the Attorney General disagreed with nearly every single relevant part of the immigration services as they are nested inside justice, you've got a real question of, well, firstly, why do you think they're all wrong? And secondly, are you right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
kind of important.
Justice officials, there's kind of a hierarchy inside the departments, and you get a sense as you deal with them. Some departments are more highly qualified and more highly credentialed than others. For my money, I would say the two best departments, as in have the best, what they would call, Michael, human capital,
yes,
would be finance and justice.
Okay.
People in justice tend to be quite bright. They tend to be quite well credentialed. They tend to be quite good at their jobs. So I would be very interested to know how a half dozen high-ranking justice officials overseeing internal divisions and presumably talking to the people in those divisions in order to ascertain what the common view is, were all wrong. And not just wrong, but so clearly wrong that ministers felt comfortable saying that there was absolutely no chance that there would be any impact on our laws from doing this.
Well, it begs the fairly obvious question, doesn't it, Gary? If they are wrong on this, and that means that they are fairly dramatically wrong on this, and they're all wrong on this, and these are the top people in the department, we have a very serious problem in the Department of Justice. Because if these people are wrong on this, why should we be confident they're going to be right on any other part of legislation that they're dealing with? Or the criminal justice system, or the immigration system? We should be terrified. If all of these people who are at the top of their various sections of the department are not only wrong, but, by the way, Gary, very wrong, but then we need to be worried.
I mean, Michael, these are not people unfamiliar with the law in these areas.
No. And yes, wrong.
There was an interesting, one of the questions the survey asked was, are there any, is there any pieces of case law or anything else you rely on that might be vulnerable to court cases if these amendments go through? And the visa unit says, now some do just list law after law that might have a problem with, but the visa unit's answer is that regarding case law, the number of judgments this would undermine or render irrelevant is simply to mention or too many to mention, realistically, any instance where we have received a judgment on a joint family application involving an extended family member would be potentially vulnerable. Any instance where they've received a judgment on that. And that became, through some process, presumably the Attorney General saying, well, that's not actually a concern, strongly enough that the government then said, with a tone of you're stupid to suggest it, there will be no changes. I mean, then again, I mean, Michael, that was Helen McEntee who did say that there would be no changes, that the, what was the line she said when she was on against McDowell?
There will be no changes. Yeah, yeah. We already have laws. Yeah.
Yes.
God.
As if law did not flow from the Constitution, it flowed from law to the Constitution. Which is not a great line for the Minister of Justice to say.
No, it was a bit of a worry, the Minister. But no, however, we should remember, there were prominent lawyers, professors of law, who were also of the opinion and said, no, we shouldn't be worried about this because we know from experience how this will be interpreted. The Supreme Court is not some kind of a radical body. They're going to just upturn everything. This will be understood in the context of marriage-like institutions, I think somebody said. Or, you know, don't worry about it. Now, he may have been right. Fact is, the framers of legislation and the heads of the department within the Department of Justice very much were of a different opinion. Not that he was wrong. I mean, we should be clear. It says vulnerable. It doesn't say, because they can't say, I suppose, with an absolute certainty that the courts would find one way or the other. But they do have they are expressing a very high level of concern. And the other thing is that they seem to be absolutely clear on is, and clear is maybe the wrong word, that this would create chaos. It would create chaos, and there would be no sense that we would know where was solid ground and where was quicksand. When the example they gave of somebody presenting at the board or whatever, we don't know how we would be able to respond to that.
No, I mean, that was something the visa unit noted, that, you know, they said we will be left in a legal grey area for several years while we wait for legal precedents to be established. That's going to create more delays and backlogs, and this is going to create, I believe the phrase was, massive, massive legal costs to the department and to the state.
Does it say massive, massive?
And then when you... It does massive, say massive, massive.
No, there you go.
It's a sort of I cannot emphasize enough how massive these costs will be. But then I think one of the reasons that I was interested in looking into this is that what we were hearing from the government about how this none of this was going to be a problem, it wouldn't have any impact on existing laws, was that occasionally they would say something that very much sounded like impact on existing laws.
Yes.
Like they would say something like, well, that will be up to the courts to decide. And you're like, okay, well, now it sounds like there are court cases coming from this.
Yeah.
And you know there's going to be court cases coming from this, you know, several years, perhaps, of court cases to establish legal precedents. Or we had Leo Varadkar come out and say, well, the meaning of durable relationship is well understood and defined in European law, which was swiftly followed by Roderick O'Gorman saying, actually, the definition of it in European law is entirely different to the definition of it that we are going to use. And they're like, well, we have the head of the government saying it's one thing, and then the minister who is seen as the person primarily driving this.
Also an academic lawyer.
Saying, no, this is not the same thing. So there seemed a lot of, like, there was a general tone of, oh, no, it'll all be fine. But no one could quite agree on how it would be fine.
Well, they couldn't agree on much, could they? I mean, not speaking to this particular issue, but, I mean, we both talked to people who were in the business of communications and have been in political communications for a very, very, very long time. And they both said to us, they had never seen so badly run and badly organized a campaign at the level of communications. They had no coherence. Nobody seemed to be saying Nobody seemed to know that they should be saying the same thing. They didn't seem to have a cheat sheet that everybody could check. Oh, God, that's the line we're supposed to be using. And then the only thing that they were consistent on was that the Constitution said the woman's place was in the home. Even when people said, well, no, actually, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court had said 20 years previously, this is not what it said. And then the director of the referendum commission overseeing it, also a justice, said, no, this is not what it said. And everybody else said, no, this is not what it said. And they kept saying that. They kept saying the one thing that everybody by that stage knew was not true. That one line they kept with. All the other lines they seemed to be all over the shop with. Like they hadn't worked out what they were supposed to be saying. Because my suspicion is they hadn't expected that anyone was going to ask them hard questions. They thought, oh, it'll just go through. Who cares? It's not a big deal. But it's a kind of a nice thing. And, you know, it's modern. It's progressive. It'll be okay.
This in isolation, I think, looks a particular way. This, viewed in conjunction with the previous story I did, where I was able to get FOIs from the Department of Finance and show that the wording of the Kerr Amendment had actually been specifically chosen in order to avoid putting concrete obligations upon the department or the government.
Yes.
And that was absolutely included in ministerial briefing papers, kind of put a quite bad look on the whole, well, you know, if you vote for this, we'll be able to do all these wonderful things for carers. Because at least some of those ministers, and Michael, I would assume that if one of the ministers is being briefed on something, that they are forthright with the other ministers about why they're doing something, which would indicate that all of the ministers were aware that the wording chosen was partially chosen to avoid actually putting obligations on the state. So that in itself is, I think, Michael, you could say, shabby to do that while publicly telling carers and, you know, the families of carers that this is going to be this great benefit for you, while internally you're being advised, actually, this will make sure that it will be limited. And then you have this. So, as I said, this is meant to go to the Attorney General. The government, I would assume, are just telling people the Attorney General's advice differed. They'll work on the assumption that the other papers are unlikely to go further than that. And every day we go further from the referendum, it becomes less and less of a story.
Yeah, I think that kind of what this would have been the assumption regarding this kind of stuff. Well, if it wins, it wins, and nobody will care. And if it loses, then it'll just disappear. And no one will care, and we can move on. We can say, well, that was then, this is now. And it must be pretty tedious that having lost the bloody thing, and having lost it really badly, in fact, having lost it so badly that there is a feeling that it may even have changed the general direction of politics in the country, that it has shifted things in a way, maybe not really clear if it has shifted in any particular direction, but things are now unstable, I would say. There's a sense that we don't quite know what's happening. We don't know where the voters are. We can't really trust the status quo. But after all of that, do you not think, Gary, that there is something really quite deep about this? Listeners might think that it would be ridiculously naive of me to assume in any sense that politicians would be in any sense honest or trustworthy or forthright with voters. But I think that they would be wrong. I think in a situation like this in the past, I'm not saying that they wouldn't have advocated for their position, whatever their position was regarding the amendment. And they would have tried to be as opaque as they could be. And they would have fudged the language. And they would have adverted to things, but not maybe made it very clear. And they would have tried to just smudge it and make it hard to read. But I feel in this case, barring other information, and I'm struggling to imagine what that information would look like. Barring other information, it feels to me that there was a deliberate attempt during a constitutional amendment. They simply lied to the people. That there was a fundamental break in trust. And I don't think I again, maybe this is naive, but I have a feeling even after all the crooks and the bagmen that we had in past governments, there were certain senses, there were certain areas within the social contract, certain things of propriety, that there was a certain thing that you went so far, but you didn't do that. There were lines which you didn't cross. You came very close to them. I find it hard to see how this government, when it came to changing the constitution, and here's the thing, other thing, Gary, on two articles, which it's hard to see why they would care that much about them, that they lied, and they lied straight to the face of the public about what the possible consequences of changing the constitution in this way would be.
I think, based on the FOIs I got from the Department of Finance, I think on that alone you can say that the government were dishonest. That there was a, shall we say, a unwillingness to accurately describe what they thought the amendments would actually do. The Department of Justice material is interesting in that it's entirely possible that Helen McEntee was unaware of these concerns.
Yes.
In that it went to the Attorney General. The Attorney General said, no, none of these are a concern. And then basically it was rewritten with the Attorney General's advice in mind and sent to McEntee. The problem, I think, with that is that, on one hand, that means that McEntee is not a liar. It just means that McEntee is incredibly incompetent. Because if you have so little insight into your own department that you don't realise that nearly every single part of it that deals with immigration thinks there is a problem and is deeply concerned with it, and you just don't know that that's happening, what are you doing? I mean, really, what are you doing?
So you think that this advice would have gone from the department to the AG and then from the AG to her?
I think it might have gone to the AG. The AG may have responded. It went back to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice rewrote it to basically include the AG's advice rather than their own. And then that went to McEntee.
But that would mean that the minister would have to be sitting at her desk talking to her principal officers and to the head, the secretary of the department, and presumably in the lead up to this, to the referendum, there would have been quite considerable discussions about this, that at no stage would any of those senior civil servants have adverted to her about the concerns that were felt throughout the department. I mean, concerns is a very mild word. I don't find that credible. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying I don't find it credible. No. Only if she's choosing not to hear it and framing every question so that they don't ever have to find themselves in the position of giving her an answer. And I don't think that she has the capacity to do that. Also, again, we don't know, and maybe we will never know. Maybe the stuff will continue to come out, hopefully. But I'm also sceptical in a matter like this that a briefing note that would go to the AG would not have gone elsewhere. That the AG would not at some stage have given some kind of a heads up, say, to the Taoiseach and to the Tánaiste about this. I don't believe that these departments are hermetically sealed, like some kind of old-fashioned message tube in a shop where they went in one end, came out the other end, and never went outside of that particular direction.
The point I'd make there is that the Attorney General's office is exempt from FOI documentation.
Yeah.
And if you attempt to FOI other documentation and it contains material from the Attorney General,
it will be covered.
They're perfectly willing to say that it's covered or to say that there's legal privilege on it. Now, not all departments will do that. Not all departments will do it always, but it does mean that there is a knowledge that if you can include that material into documentation, you can quite safely keep it out of the hands of FOI. So I think from what I have heard about how this process was done internally, this referendum process entirely, there were internal concerns with how it was being handled and who was handling different parts of it and who had influence on different parts of it and how much influence they should have had or should they have been involved. The problem I have is standing that up in an article and getting documents that show things happened or that people were aware of things that if you cannot find evidence of, they're just going to deny they were aware of. So that, I think, is the problem here. So we can't show explicitly that this went to McEntee. I think you're right. I think you're quite right that this is the sort of thing, if you were going to hold a referendum and officials in the Department of Justice believe things to be a certain way, there are many people who would want to be informed of that in whatever manner.
Gary.
But it is difficult to prove.
If for no other reason you want to cover your arse, and the only way you can cover your arse is by sending the memo. And you send the memo, you keep a copy of the memo, and then when the whole thing explodes, Minister, as I outlined in my memo of June the 12th, my concerns were X, Y, and Z. And I think in a situation like this, civil servants would have been covering their arse all over the place. And if they weren't, I'd say they were very foolish. Especially if their concerns were, as they seem to have been in the department, I mean, deep concerns, they would have been sending memos, they would have been telling people, so that nobody could come along and say, well, we were never told, because that's what politicians like to do. We were never told, nobody said it to us, that was not our information. So anyway, who knows, more may come out, or we may have to wait for the 30-year rule.
Well, I think, Michael, what we may have to wait for is one of these people to put their head up at a press conference that we can send Ben to.
And see, will they lie or will they just look at their shoes and say, I don't know what you're talking about? Or maybe just leave.
That's the wonderful thing about not knowing what people have actually seen. It can make answering their questions quite awkward.
Anyway, we can look forward to that, but for the time being, we will look forward to next Sunday. Are we here next Sunday? I know May is coming and there is a bank holiday, but it's in May, not before May. So it's the following week, probably, May Day, to celebrate the proletariat. So unless we're celebrating the proletariat, we should be back next Sunday. So have a great week.
All the best.